When court adjourned, she was taken by bus back to Sybil Brand, dormitory 8000, and Susan Atkins. Shortly before 5 p.m., Danny DiCarlo arrived at LAPD Homicide. He had been on his way downtown earlier when he noticed he was low on gas and had pulled into a service station. On leaving, he had made an illegal turn, had been spotted by a black and white, and after the officers checked and found he had some outstanding traffic tickets, had been hauled in. It had taken all day to secure his release. Unlike Al Springer, Danny DiCarlo looked, talked, and acted like a biker. He was short, 5'4", weighed 130 pounds, had a handlebar mustache, tattoos on both arms, and burn scars on one arm and both legs from motorcycle pileups. Wary, frequently glancing back over his shoulder as if expecting to find someone there, he spoke in a colorful jargon that the interviewing officers, Nielsen, Gutierrez, and McGann, unconsciously adopted. Now 25, he had been born in Toronto, then given U.S. citizenship after serving 4 years in the Coast Guard. His job? Weapons expert. Currently, he was in business with his father, selling firearms. When it came to the guns at Spawn Ranch, the detectives couldn't have found a better source. When he wasn't getting drunk and chasing girls, which he admitted occupied most of his time, he looked after the weapons. He not only cleaned and repaired them, he slept in the gun room where they were kept. When a weapon was taken out, Danny knew about it. He also knew a great deal about Spawn's movie ranch, which was located in Chatsworth, not more than 20 miles from downtown Beverly Hills, yet seemingly a world away. Once William S. Hart, Tom Mix, Johnny Mack Brown, and Wallace Beery had made movies here. It was said that Howard Hughes had come to Spawn to oversee personally the filming of portions of The Outlaw, and the rolling hills behind the main buildings provided settings for Duel in the Sun. Now, except for an occasional Marlboro commercial or a Bonanza episode, the main business was renting horses to weekend riders. The movie sets, Longhorn Saloon, Rock City Cafe, Undertaking Parlor, Jail, which fronted on Santa Susana Pass Road, were old now, run down, as was George Spawn, the 81-year-old near-blind owner of the ranch. For years, Ruby Pearl, a one-time circus bareback rider turned horse wrangler, had run the riding stable part of the business for George, getting hay, hiring and firing cowboys, making sure they looked after the horses and stable, and kept their hands off the two young girls who came for riding lessons. Almost sightless, George depended on Ruby, but at the end of the day, she went home to a husband and another life. Over the years, George had sired 10 children, each of whom he had named after a favorite horse. He could recall in detail the namesakes, but was less clear about the kids. All lived elsewhere, and only a few visited him with any regularity. When the Manson family arrived, in August 1968, George was living alone in a filthy trailer, feeling old, lonely, and neglected. This was long before Danny DiCarlo became involved with the family, but he had often heard the tale from those who were there. Manson, who originally asked Spawn's permission to stay for a few days, but neglected to mention that there were 25 to 30 people with him, assigned Squeaky to look after George. Squeaky, true name Lynette Frome, had been with Manson more than a year at that time, having been one of the first girls to join him. She was thin, red-headed, covered with freckles. Though 19, she looked much younger. DiCarlo told the detectives, she had George in the palm of her hand. She cleaned for him, cooked for him, balanced his checkbook, made love with him. Question, unbelievingly, she did? That old son of a gun. Answer, yeah. Charlie's trip was to get George, so he had so much faith in Squeaky that come time for George to go off into the happy hunting ground, he'd turn the ranch over to Squeaky. That was their thing. Charlie'd always tell her what to tell George, and she'd report back to Charlie anything anyone else told him. Squeaky maintained that she was George's eyes. According to DiCarlo, they saw only what Charlie Manson wanted them to see. Possibly because he suspected, Possibly because his own children, on their occasional visits, strongly resisted the idea, George never did get around to willing the property to Squeaky, which, the detective surmised, was probably why he was still alive out at Spawn Ranch. George Spawn had frustrated one of Charlie's plans. Danny DiCarlo had played along with, then failed to come through on another. Manson's scheme to get the motorcycle gangs to join him in terrorizing society, as DiCarlo put it. Danny had met Manson in March 1969, just after separating from his wife. He had gone to Spawn to repair some bikes and had stayed. "I had a ball," he later admitted. Manson's girls had been taught that having babies and caring for men were their sole purpose in life. DiCarlo liked being cared for, and the girls, at least at first, appeared very affectionate toward Donkey Dan, a nickname they had bestowed upon him because of certain physical endowments. Manson told DiCarlo that because he, Manson, was less amply endowed, he needed DiCarlo to keep the girls from running away. This sounds like a Manson con, though DiCarlo maintains it was true. There were problems. Charlie was against drinking. Danny liked nothing better than to swill beer and lie in the sun. Later he testified that while at Spawn he was smashed probably 90% of the time. And with the exception of a couple of special sweeties, DiCarlo eventually tired of most of the girls. "They would always try preaching to me. It was always the same shit Charlie preached to them." With the August 15th visit of the Straight Satans, Manson must have realized that he would never succeed in getting the bikers to join him. After that, Danny was ignored, left out of family conferences, while the girls denied him their favors. Though he went to Barker Ranch with the group, he stayed only 3 days. He split, DiCarlo said, because he had begun to believe all the murder talk he had heard, and because he had strong suspicions that unless he left, he might be next. "After that," he said, "I started watching my back." When the LaBianca detectives had talked to DiCarlo the previous Thursday, he'd promised to try to locate Manson's sword. He turned it over to Sergeant Gutierrez, who booked it as the personal property of Manson Charles M. Probable crime, 187 PC. Murder. The sword had accumulated a history. A few weeks after Danny moved to Spawn, the president of the Straight Satans, George Knoll, a.k.a. 86 George, had visited him. Manson had admired George's sword and had conned him out of it by promising to pay a $20 traffic ticket George owed. According to Danny, the sword became one of Charlie's favorite weapons. He had a metal scabbard built for it, next to the steering wheel of his personal dune buggy. When the Straight Satans came to get Danny the night of August 15th, they spotted the sword and reclaimed it. On learning that it was dirty, i.e. had been used in a crime, they had broken it in half. It was in 2 pieces when DiCarlo handed it over to Gutierrez. Overall length, 20 inches. Blade length, 15 inches. The width of its razor-sharp blade, the tip of which had been honed on both sides, was 1 inch. This was the sword, according to DiCarlo, that Manson had used to slice Gary Hinman's ear. From DiCarlo, the detectives now learned that in addition to Bobby Beausoleil and Susan Atkins, 3 others had been involved in the murder of Hinman: Manson, Mary Brunner, and Bruce Davis. DiCarlo's primary source was Beausoleil, who, on returning to Spawn after the murder, had bragged to DiCarlo about what he had done. Or as Danny put it, "He came back with a big head the next day, you know, just like he got him a cherry." The story, as DiCarlo claimed Beausoleil had related it to him, went as follows. Mary Brunner, Susan Atkins, and Bobby Beausoleil had dropped in on Hinman, bullshitting about old times and everything like that. Bobby then asked Gary for all his money, saying they needed it. When Gary said he didn't have any money, Bobby pulled out a gun, a 9mm Polish Radom automatic, and started pistol-whipping him. In the scuffle, the gun went off, the bullet hitting no one but ricocheting through the kitchen. LASO found a 9mm slug lodged under the kitchen sink. Beausoleil then called Manson at Spawn Ranch and told him, "You'd better get up here, Charlie. Gary ain't cooperating." Since the Hinman residence in Malibu and Spahn's movie ranch in Chatsworth were in the same dialing area, this was not a toll call. Therefore, the telephone company kept no record of it. A short time later, Manson and Bruce Davis arrived at the Hinman residence. Puzzled and hurt, Gary pleaded with Charlie, asking him to take the others and leave. He didn't want any trouble. He couldn't understand why they were doing this to him. They had always been friends. According to DiCarlo, Charlie didn't say anything. He just hit him with the sword. Whack. Cut part of his ear off, or all of it. Hinman's left ear had been split in half. So Gary went down and was really going through some changes about losing his ear. Manson gave him a choice. Sign over everything he had, or die. Manson and Davis then left. Though Beausoleil did obtain the pink slips, California automobile ownership papers on two of Hinman's vehicles, Gary continued to insist he had no money. When more pistol whipping failed to convince him, Bobby again called Manson at Spahn, telling him, "We ain't going to get nothing out of him. He ain't going to give up nothing. And we can't just leave. He's got his ear hacked off and he'll go to the police." Manson replied, "Well, you know what to do." And Beausoleil did it. Bobby said he went up to Gary again, took the knife and struck him with it. He said he had to do it 3 or 4 times. Hinman was really bleeding and he was gasping for air, and Bobby said he knelt down next to him and said, "Gary, you know what? You got no reason to be on Earth anymore. You're a pig, and society don't need you, so this is the best way for you to go, and you should thank me for putting you out of your misery." Then Hinman made noises in his throat, his last gasping breath, and wow, away he went. Question. So Bobby told him he was a pig. Answer. Right. You see, the fight against society was the number one element in this. Question. Skeptically. Yeah, we'll get into his philosophy and all that bullshit later. They never did. DiCarlo went on. Before leaving the house, they wrote on the wall, "White Piggy," or "Whitey," or "Kill the Piggies," something along that line. Beausoleil also dipped his hand in Hinman's blood, and using his palm made a paw print on the wall. The plan was to push the blame onto the Black Panthers, who used the paw print as their symbol. Then they hotwired Hinman's Volkswagen microbus and his Fiat station wagon and drove both back to Spahn Ranch, where Beausoleil bragged about his exploits to DiCarlo. Later, apparently fearful that the palm print might be identifiable, Beausoleil returned to the Hinman residence and attempted unsuccessfully to wipe it off the wall. This was several days after Hinman's death, and Beausoleil later told DiCarlo that he could hear the maggots eating away on Gary. Beausoleil, Brunner, and Atkins went to Hinman's residence on Friday, July 25th, 1969. Manson slashed Hinman's ear sometime late that night. Hinman was not killed, however, until Sunday, July 27th, and it was not until the following Thursday, July 31st, that his body was discovered by LASO, following a report from a friend who had been trying to reach Hinman for several days. As killers, they had been decidedly amateurish. Not only was the palm print identifiable, so was a latent fingerprint Beausoleil had left in the kitchen. They kept Hinman's Volkswagen and his Fiat at the ranch for several days, where a number of people saw them. Ironically, on July 28th, two LASO deputies, Olmsted and Grapp, visited Spahn Ranch on another matter. While there, they saw the Fiat, ran a spot check on the license, and learned that it belonged to Gary Hinman. Grapp knew Hinman. He also knew he was a friend of the people at Spahn Ranch, and therefore didn't feel there was anything suspicious about the station wagons being there. At this time, although Hinman was dead, his body had not yet been discovered. After the discovery of the body on July 31st, LASO put out a want on Hinman's vehicles. Grapp didn't learn of it or Hinman's death until much later. If he had known, of course, he could have directed the investigation to Spahn Ranch and the Manson family months before Kitty Lutzinger implicated Atkins and the others. Hinman had played bagpipes, a decidedly uncommon musical instrument. Beausoleil and the girls took his set back to Spahn Ranch, where for a time they remained on a shelf in the kitchen. DiCarlo, for one, had tried to play them. And Beausoleil did not discard the knife, but continued to carry it with him. It was in the tire well when he was arrested on August 6th, driving Hinman's Fiat. DiCarlo drew a picture of the knife Beausoleil claimed he had used to stab Hinman. It was a pencil-thin miniature Bowie, with an eagle on the handle and a Mexican inscription. It tallied perfectly with the knife recovered from the Fiat. DiCarlo also sketched the 9mm radon, which as yet hadn't been recovered. The detectives asked him what other handguns he had seen at Spahn. Answer? Well, there was a 22 Buntline. When they did that Black Panther, I didn't want to touch it. I didn't want to clean it. I didn't want to be nowhere around it. DiCarlo claimed he didn't know whose gun it was, but he said Charlie always used to carry it in a holster on the front of him. It was more or less always with him. Sometime, around July, maybe June, the gun just popped up. When was the last time he saw it? I know I didn't see it for at least a week before the raid. The Spahn Ranch raid had taken place on August 16th. A week earlier would be August 9th, the date of the Tate homicides. Question. Did you ever ask Charlie, where's your gun? Answer. He said, I just gave it away. He liked it, so I figured it was maybe just stashed. The detectives had DiCarlo draw the buntline. It was nearly identical with the photo of the high-standard Longhorn model sent out in the LAPD flyer. Later, DiCarlo was shown the flyer and asked, Does this look like the gun you mentioned? Answer, It sure does. Question, What's the difference between that gun and the gun that you saw? Answer, No difference at all. Only the rear sight blade was different. It didn't have any. The detectives had DiCarlo run down what he knew about the murder of the Black Panther. Springer had first mentioned the killing to them when they interviewed him. In the interim, they had done some checking and had come up with a slight problem. No such murder had ever been reported. According to DiCarlo, after Tex burned the guy for $2,500 on a grass deal, the Panther had called Charlie at Spahn Ranch, threatening that if he didn't make good, he and his brothers were going to wipe out the whole ranch. That same night, Charlie and a guy named TJ went to the Panther's place in North Hollywood. Charlie had a plan. He put the 22 bunt line in his belt in back. On a signal, TJ was to yank out the gun, step out from behind Charlie, and plug the Panther. Nail him right there. Only TJ had chickened out, and Manson had to do the shooting himself. Friends of the Black, who were present when the shooting occurred, had later dumped the body in Griffith Park, Danny said. Danny had seen the $2,500 and had been present the next morning when Manson criticized TJ for backing down. DiCarlo described TJ as a really nice guy. His front was trying to be one of Charlie's boys, but he didn't have it inside. TJ had gone along with Manson on everything up to this, but he told him, I don't want to have nothing to do with snuffing people. A day or two later, he fled in the wind. Question. Who else got murdered up there? What about Shorty? Do you know anything about that? There was a long pause, then, That was my ace in the hole. Question. How so? Answer. I was going to save that for the last. Question. Well, might as well clear the thing up now. Has Charlie got something he can smear on you that... Answer. No. No way at all. Nothing. One thing did worry DiCarlo, however. In 1966, he had been convicted of a felony, smuggling marijuana across the Mexican border, a federal charge. He was currently appealing the sentence. He was also under indictment on two other charges. Along with Al Springer and several other straight Satans, he had been charged with selling a stolen motorcycle engine, which was a local charge, and giving false information while purchasing a firearm, using an alias and not disclosing that he had a prior felony conviction, which was federal. Manson was still on parole from a federal pen. So what if they send me to the same place? I don't want to feel a shank in my back and find that little son of a bitch behind me. Question. Let me explain something to you, Danny, so you know where you stand. We're dealing with a guy here who we are pretty sure is responsible for about 13 murders, some of which you don't know about. The figure 13 was just a guess, but DiCarlo surprised them by saying, I know about... I'm pretty sure he did Tate. Question. Okay. We've talked about the Panther. We've talked about Gary Hinman. We're going to talk about Shorty. And you think he did Tate. That's 8. Now, we've got 5 more. All right? Now, our opinion of Charlie is that he's got a little mental problem. But we're in no way going to jeopardize you or anyone else if, for no other reason, we don't want another murder. We're in business to stop murders. And in this business, there's no sense in solving 13 murders if somebody else is going to get killed. That just makes 14. Answer. I'm a nasty motorcycle rider. Question. I don't care what you are personally. Answer. The police's general opinion of me is nothing. Question. That's not my opinion. Answer. I'm not an outstanding citizen. Question. As I told you the other day, Danny, you level with us all the way, right down the line, no bullshitting. I'm not going to bullshit you, you're not going to bullshit me. We level with each other and I'll go out for you 100%. And I mean it. So that you don't have to go to the joint. Question. Another detective. We've dealt with motorcycle riders before and with all kinds of people. We've gone out on a limb to help them because they've helped us. We'll do our very best to make sure that nobody gets killed, whether he's a motorcycle rider or the best citizen in the world. Now tell us what you know about Shorty. Early that same evening, November 17, 1969, two LAPD homicide officers, Sergeants Mossman and Brown, appeared at Sybil Brand Institute and asked to see one Ronnie Howard. The interview was brief. They heard enough, however, to realize they were on to something big. Enough, too, to decide it wasn't the best idea to leave Ronnie Howard in the same dormitory with Susan Atkins. Before leaving Sybil Brand, they arranged to have Ronnie move to an isolation unit. Then they drove back to Parker Center, anxious to tell the other detectives that they had cracked the case. Nielsen, Gutierrez, and McGann were still questioning DiCarlo about the murder of Shorty. They already knew something about it, even before talking to Springer and DiCarlo, since Sergeants Whiteley and Gunther had begun their own investigation into the possible homicide after talking to Kitty Lutzinger. They knew Shorty was Donald Jerome Shea, a 36-year-old male Caucasian who had worked at Spawn Ranch on and off for some 15 years as a horse wrangler. Like most of the other cowboys who drifted in and out of Spawn's movie ranch, Shorty was just awaiting the day when some producer discovered he had all the potentials of a new John Wayne or Clint Eastwood. Whenever the prospect of any acting job materialized, Shorty would quit work and go in search of that ever-elusive stardom, which explained why, when in late August he disappeared from Spawn, no one thought too much about it. At first... Kitty had also told LASO that Manson, Clem, Bruce, and possibly Tex had been involved in the killing, and that some of the girls in the family had helped obliterate all traces of the crime. One thing they didn't know, and now asked Danny, was, why did they do it? Answer, because Shorty was going to old man Spawn and snitching, and Charlie didn't like snitches. Question. Just about the petty bullshit at the ranch? Answer. That's right. Shorty was telling old man Spawn that he should put him in charge and he would clean everybody up. He would, in short order, run off Manson and his family. Shorty, however, made a fatal mistake. He forgot that little Squeaky was not only George's eyes, she was also Charlie's ears. There were other reasons which Danny enumerated. Shorty had married a black topless dancer. Charlie had a thing about interracial marriages and blacks. Charlie had two enemies, DeCarlo said, the police and the niggers, in that order. Charlie also suspected that Shorty had helped set up the August 16th raid on Spawn. Shorty had been offed about 10 days later. The exact date of Shay's death still remains unknown. It is believed to have occurred on either the night of Monday, August 25th, or Tuesday, August 26th, 1969. And there was the possibility, though this was strictly conjecture on DeCarlo's part, that Shorty had overheard something about some of the other murders. Bruce Davis had told him about Shorty's murder, DeCarlo said. Several of the girls had also mentioned it, as had both Clem and Manson. Danny was unclear as to some of the details, how they had managed to catch Shorty off guard and where, but as for the mode of death, he was more than graphic. Like they were going to do Caesar, they went to the gun room and picked up a sword and four German bayonets, the latter purchased from an army surplus store for $1 each and honed to razor sharpness. Then, getting Shorty off by himself, they stuck him like carving up a Christmas turkey. Bruce said they cut him up in 9 pieces. They cut his head off. Then they cut his arms off, too, so there was no way they could possibly identify him. They were laughing about that. After killing him, they covered the body with leaves, DeCarlo guessed, but was not sure that this had occurred in one of the canyons behind the ranch buildings. Some of the girls had helped dispose of Shorty's bloody clothing, his automobile, and other possessions. Then Clem came back the next day or that night and buried him good. Question. Unidentified voice. Can we break this up for about 15 minutes? Maybe send Danny up to get some coffee? There's been an accident, and they want to talk to you guys. Question. Sure. Question. I'm going to send Danny up to the 8th floor. I want him back down here in 15 minutes. Answer. I'll wait right here. Danny was not anxious to be seen wandering the halls of LAPD. Question. It won't take more than 15 minutes. We'll close the door so nobody will know you're in here. There had been no accident. Mossman and Brown had returned from Sybil Brand. As they related what they had heard, the 15 minutes stretched to nearly 45. Although the Atkins-Howard conversations left many unanswered questions, the detectives were now convinced that the Tate and LaBianca cases had been solved. As will become all too apparent, in this instance, solved was a misstatement if ever there was one. Susan Atkins had told Ronnie Howard details. The unpublished words written at the LaBianca residence, the lost knife at Tate, which only one of the killers could know. Lieutenants Helder, Tate, and LePage, LaBianca, were notified. When the detectives returned to the interrogation room, they were in a light-hearted mood. Question. Now, when we left Shorty, he was in 9 pieces, and his head and arms were off. DeCarlo was not told what they had learned, but he must have sensed a change in the questioning. The matter of Shorty was quickly wrapped up. Tate was now the topic. Exactly why did Danny think Manson was involved? Well, there were 2 incidents. Or maybe it was the same incident, Danny was not sure. Anyway, they went out on one caper and they came back with $75. Tex was in on that. And he fucked up his foot, fucking somebody out of it. I don't know whether he put his lights out or not, but he got $75. There were no calendars at Spawn Ranch, DeCarlo had told them earlier. No one paid much attention to what day it was. The one date everyone at the ranch remembered, however, was August 16th, the day of the raid. It was before this. Question. How much before? Answer. Oh, 2 weeks. If DeCarlo's estimate was correct, this would also be before Tate. What was the other incident? Answer. They went out one night. Everybody went but Bruce. Question. Who went? Answer. Charlie, Tex, and Clem. Them three. Okay, the next morning, one of the detectives interrupted. Had he actually seen them leave? No, only the next morning. Another interruption. Did any of the girls go that night? Answer. No, I am almost positive it was just them three that went. Question. Well, do you remember? Were the rest of the girls there that night? Answer. See, the girls were scattered all over the place, and there is no possible way that I could have kept track of who was there and who wasn't there. So it was possible the girls could have gone without DiCarlo's knowing about it. Now, what about the date? This one Danny remembered, more or less, because he was rebuilding the engine on his bike and had to go into town to get a bearing. It was around the 9th, 10th, or 11th of August, and they split that night, and they came back the next morning. Clem was standing in front of the kitchen, DiCarlo said. Danny walked up to him and asked, "What did you do last night?" Clem, according to Danny, smiled that real stupid smile of his. Danny glanced back over his shoulder and saw that Charlie was standing behind him. He got the impression that Clem had been about to answer, but that Charlie had signaled him to be quiet. Clem said something like, "Don't worry about it. We did all right." At this point, Charlie walked off. Before starting after him, Clem put his hand on Danny's arm and said, "We got 5 piggies." There was a great big grin on his face. Clem told DiCarlo, "We got 5 piggies." Manson told Springer, "We knocked off 5 of them just the other night." Atkins confessed to Howard that she stabbed Sharon Tate and Wojtek Frykowski. Beausoleil confessed to DiCarlo that he had stabbed Hinman. Atkins told Howard that she had done the stabbing. Suddenly, the detectives had a surfeit of confessors, so many that they were thoroughly confused as to who was involved in which homicides. Skipping Hinman, which after all was the sheriff's case, and concentrating on Tate, they had 2 versions. One, DiCarlo felt that Charlie, Clem, and Tex, without the help of any of the girls, had killed Sharon Tate and the others. 2, Ronnie Howard understood Susan Atkins to say that she, 2 other girls, the names Linda and Katie had been mentioned, but whether they were involved in this particular homicide was unclear, plus Charles, plus possibly 1 other man, had gone to 10,050 Cielo Drive. As for the LaBianca murders, all they knew was that there were 2 girls and Charlie, that Linda wasn't in on this one, and that Susan Atkins was somehow involved in that collective we. The detectives decided to try another approach, through the other girls at the ranch, but first they wanted to wrap up a few loose ends. What clothing had the 3 men been wearing? "Dark clothing," DiCarlo replied. Charlie had on a black sweater, Levi's, moccasins. Tex was dressed similarly, he thought, though he may have been wearing boots, he wasn't sure. Clem wore Levi's and moccasins, too, plus an olive drab field jacket. Had he noticed any blood on their clothes when he saw them the next morning? No, but then he hadn't been looking for any. Did he have any idea which vehicle they took? Sure, Johnny Swartz's 59 Ford. It was the only car working at that time. Any idea where it was now? It had been hauled off during the August 16th raid, and, so far as Danny knew, was probably still in the impound garage in Canoga Park. Swartz was one of the ranch hands at Spawn, not a family member, but he let them borrow his car. Any idea what Tex's true name was? Charles was his first name, Danny said. He'd seen the last name once on a pink slip, but couldn't recall it. Was it Charles Montgomery, the detectives asked, using a name Kitty Lutzinger had supplied? No, that didn't sound familiar. What about Clem? Does the name Tufts ring any bell? No, he'd never heard Clem called that, but that boy that was found shot up in Topanga Canyon, the 16-year-old kid, wasn't his name Tufts? One of the detectives replied, "I don't know. That's the sheriff's case. We got so many murders now." Okay. Now about the girls. How well did you know the broads out there? Answer. Pretty well, man. Laughter. The detectives began going through the names the girls had used when arrested in the Spahn and Barker raids, and they immediately encountered problems. Not only had they used aliases when booked, they also used them at the ranch. And not a single alias, but several, seemingly changing names like clothes whenever the mood hit them. As a further complication, they even traded aliases. As if these weren't problems enough, Danny provided another. He was extremely reluctant to admit that any of the girls might be capable of murder. The guys were something else. Bobby, Tex, Bruce, Clem, any would kill, DiCarlo felt, if Charlie told him to. All, it later turned out, had. Ella Jo Bailey was eliminated. She'd left Spahn Ranch before the murders. Mary Brunner and Sandra Good were out also. They'd been in jail both nights. What about Ruth Ann Smack, a.k.a. Ruth Ann Hubelhurst? These were booking names. Her true name was Ruth Ann Morehouse, and she was known in the family as Wish. Danny knew this, but for personal reasons didn't bother to enlighten the detectives. Question. What do you know about her? Answer. She used to be one of my favorite sweeties. Question. Do you think she would have the guts to get into a cold-blooded murder? Danny hesitated a long time before answering. You know, that little girl there is so sweet. What really made me sick to my stomach is when she came up one night, when I was up there in the desert, and she said, I can hardly wait to get my first pig. Little 17-year-old. I looked on her like she was my daughter, just the sweetest little thing you would ever want to meet in your life. She was so beautiful and so sweet. And Charlie fucked her thinking around so much it turned your guts. The date when she told DiCarlo this was determined to be about September 1st. If she hadn't killed by then, she couldn't have been in on LaBianca or Tate. Eliminate Ruth Ann. Ever know a Katie? Yeah, but he didn't know what her real name was. I never knew anyone by their real name, DiCarlo said. Katie was an older broad, not a runaway. She was from down around Venice. His description of her was vague, except that she had so much hair on her body that none of the guys wanted to make it with her. What about a Linda? She was a short broad, Danny said. But she didn't stay long, maybe only a month or so, and he didn't know much about her. She'd left by the time they raided Spahn Ranch. When Sadie went out on creepy crawling missions, did she carry any weapons? One of the detectives asked. Answer. She carried a little knife. They had a bunch of little hunting knives. Buck hunting knives. Question. Buck knives. Answer. Buck knives, right. They now began firing specific questions at DiCarlo. Ever see any credit cards with an Italian name on them? Anybody ever talk about somebody who owned a boat? Ever hear anyone use the name LaBianca? Danny gave no answers to all. What about glasses? Anybody at Spahn wear them? None of them wore glasses because Charlie wouldn't let them wear glasses. Mary Brunner had had several pairs. Charlie had broken them. DiCarlo was shown some two-strand nylon rope. Ever see any rope like this up at Spahn? No, but he had seen some three-strand. Charlie had bought about 200 feet of it at the Jack Frost surplus store in Santa Monica in June or July. Was he sure about that? Sure he was sure. He'd been along when Charlie bought it. Later he'd coiled it so it wouldn't develop snags. It was the same as they used in the Coast Guard on PT boats. He'd handled it hundreds of times. Although DiCarlo was unaware of it, the Tate Sebring rope was also three-strand. Probably by pre-arrangement, the detectives began to lean on DiCarlo, adopting a tougher tone. Question. Did you ever caper with any of the guys? Answer. Fuck no. No way at all. Ask any of the girls. Question. Did you have anything to do with Shorty's death? DiCarlo denied it vehemently. Shorty had been his friend. Besides, I've got no balls for putting anybody's lights out. But there was just enough hesitation in his reply to indicate he was hiding something. Pressed, DiCarlo told them about Shorty's guns. Shorty had a matched pair of Colt 45s. He was always hawking, then reclaiming the pistols. In late August or early September, after Shorty had disappeared, but supposedly before DiCarlo knew what had happened to him, Bruce Davis had given him Shorty's pawn tickets on the guns in repayment for some money he owed DiCarlo. Danny had reclaimed the pistols. Later, learning that Shorty had been killed, he'd sold the guns to a Culver City shop for $75. Question. That puts you in a pretty shitty spot. You're aware of that? Danny was. And he got in even deeper when one of the detectives asked him if he knew anything about Lime. When arrested, Mary Brunner was carrying a shopping list made up by Manson. Lime was one of the items listed. Any idea why Charlie would want some lime? Danny recalled that Charlie had once asked him what to use to decompose a body. He had told him lime worked best because he had once used it to get rid of a cat that had died under a house. Question. Why did you tell him that? Answer. No particular reason. He was just asking me. Question. What did he ask you? Answer. Oh, the best way to, to get rid of a body real quick. Question. Did you ever think to say, now what in the fuck makes you ask a question like that, Charlie? Answer. No, because he was nuts. Question. When did that conversation take place? Answer. Right around the time Shorty disappeared. It looked bad, and the detectives left it at that. Although privately they were inclined to accept DiCarlo's tale, suspecting, however, that although he probably had not taken part in the murder, he still knew more than he was telling, it gave them some additional leverage to try and get what they wanted. They wanted two things. Question. Anybody left up at Spawn Ranch that knows you? Answer. Not that I know of. I don't know who's up there. And I don't want to go up there to find out. I don't want nothing to do with the place. Question. I want to look around there, but I need a guide. Danny didn't volunteer. They made the other request straight out. Question. Would you be willing to testify? Answer. No, sir. There were two charges pending against him, they reminded him. On the stolen motorcycle engine, maybe we can get it busted down to a lesser charge. Maybe we can go so far as to get it knocked off. As far as the federal thing is concerned, I don't know how much weight we can push on that. But here again, we can try. Answer. If you try for me, that's fine. That's all I can ask of you. If it came down to being a witness or going to jail, DiCarlo hesitated. Then when he gets out of jail... Question. He isn't going to get out of jail on no first-degree murder beef when you've got over five victims involved. If Manson was the guy that was in on the Tate murder, we don't know that for a fact yet. We've got a great deal of information that way. Answer. There's also a reward involved in that. Question. Yes, there is. Quite a bit of a reward. $25,000. Not to say that one guy is going to get it, but even split, that's a hell of a piece of cash. Answer. I could send my boy through military school with that. Question. Now, what do you think? Would you be willing to testify against this group of people? Answer. He's going to be sitting there looking at me. Manson is, isn't he? Question. If you go to trial and testify, he is. Now, how scared of Manson are you? Answer. I'm scared shitless. I'm petrified of him. He wouldn't hesitate for a second. If it takes him 10 years, he'd find that little boy of mine and carve him to pieces. Question. You give that motherfucker more credit than he deserves. If you think Manson is some kind of a god that is going to break out of jail and come back and murder everybody that testified against him... But it was obvious DiCarlo didn't put that past Manson. Even if he remained in jail, there were the others. Answer. What about Clem? Have you got him locked up? Question. Yeah. Clem is sitting in the cooler up in Independence with Charlie. Answer. What about Tex and Bruce? Question. They're both out. Bruce Davis, the last I heard, sometime earlier this month, was in Venice. Answer. Bruce is down in Venice, huh? I'll have to watch myself. One of my club brothers said he spotted a couple of the girls down in Venice, too. The detectives didn't tell DiCarlo that when Davis was last seen, on November 5th, it was in connection with another death, the suicide of Zero. By this time, LAPD had learned that Zero, a.k.a. Christopher Jesus, true name John Philip Haught, had been arrested in the Barker raid. Earlier, in going through some photographs, DiCarlo had identified Scotty and Zero as two young boys from Ohio who had been with the family for a short time but didn't fit in. One of the detectives had remarked, "Zero's no longer with us." Answer. What do you mean he's no longer with us? Question. He's among the dead. Answer. Oh, shit, is he? Question. Yeah, he got a little too high one day, and he was playing Russian roulette. He parked a bullet in his head. While the detectives had apparently bought the story of Zero's death, as related by Bruce Davis and the others, Danny didn't. Not for a minute. No. Danny didn't want to testify. The detectives left it at that. There was still time for him to change his mind. And after all, they now had Ronnie Howard. They let Danny go after making arrangements for him to call in the next day. One of the detectives commented after Danny had left, but while the tape was still on, "I kind of feel like we've done a day's work." The DiCarlo interview had lasted over 7 hours. It was now past midnight on Tuesday, November 18th, 1969. I was already asleep, unaware that in a few hours, as a result of a meeting between the DA and his staff that morning, I would be handed the job of prosecuting the Tate-LaBianca killers. Part 3. The Investigation, Phase 2. No sense makes sense. Charles Manson. November 18th, 1969. By now the listener knows a great deal more about the Tate-LaBianca murders than I did on the day I was assigned that case. In fact, since large portions of the foregoing story have not been made public before this, the reader is an insider in a sense highly unusual in a murder case. And in a way, I am a newcomer, an intruder. The sudden switch from an unseen background narrator to a very personal account is bound to be a surprise. The best way to soften it, I suspect, would be to introduce myself. Then, when we've got that out of the way, we'll resume the narrative together. This digression, though unfortunately necessary, will be as brief as possible. A conventional biographical sketch before the Manson trial would probably have read more or less as follows. Vincent T. Bugliosi, age 35, Deputy District Attorney, Los Angeles, California. Born Hibbing, Minnesota. Graduate Hollywood High School. Attended the University of Miami on a tennis scholarship, BA and BBA degrees. Deciding on the practice of law, attended UCLA, LLB degree, President graduating class 1964. Joined the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office same year. Has tried a number of highly publicized murder cases, Floyd Milton, Perveller Cromwell, etc., obtaining convictions in all. Has tried 104 felony jury trials, losing only one. In addition to his duties as deputy DA, Bugliosi is a professor of criminal law at Beverly School of Law, Los Angeles. Served as technical consultant and edited the scripts of two pilot films for Jack Webb's TV series, The DA. Series star Robert Conrad patterned his part after the young prosecutor. Married, two children. That's probably about how it would read, yet it tells nothing about how I feel toward my profession, which is even more important. The primary duty of a lawyer engaged in public prosecution is not to convict, but to see that justice is done. Those words are from the old canon of ethics of the American Bar Association. I'd thought of them often during the 5 years I'd been a deputy DA. In a very real sense, they had become my personal credo. If in a given case a conviction is justice, so be it. But if it is not, I want no part of it. For far too many years, the stereotyped image of the prosecutor has been either that of a right-wing, law-and-order type intent on winning convictions at any cost, or a stumbling, bumbling Hamilton burger, forever trying innocent people who, fortunately, are saved at the last possible minute by the foxy maneuverings of a Perry Mason. I've never felt the defense attorney has a monopoly on concern for innocence, fairness, and justice. After joining the DA's office, I tried close to 1,000 cases. In a great many, I sought and obtained convictions because I believed the evidence warranted them. In a great many others, in which I felt the evidence was insufficient, I stood up in court and asked for a dismissal of the charges, or requested a reduction in either the charges or the sentence. The latter cases rarely make headlines. Only infrequently does the public learn of them. Thus, the stereotype remains. Far more important, however, is the realization that fairness and justice have prevailed. Just as I never felt the slightest compunction to conform to this stereotype, so did I rebel against another. Traditionally, the role of the prosecutor has been twofold: to handle the legal aspects of the case, and to present in court the evidence gathered by law enforcement agencies. I never accepted these limitations. In past cases, I always joined in the investigation, going out and interviewing witnesses myself, tracking down and developing new leads, often finding evidence otherwise overlooked. In some cases, this led to the release of a suspect, in others to a conviction that otherwise might not have been obtained. For a lawyer to do less than his utmost is, I strongly feel, a betrayal of his client. Though in criminal trials one tends to focus on the defense attorney and his client the accused, the prosecutor is also a lawyer, and he too has a client, the people. And the people are equally entitled to their day in court, to a fair and impartial trial, and to justice. The Tate-LaBianca case was the farthest thing from my mind on the afternoon of November 18, 1969. I'd just completed a long trial and was on my way back to my office in the Hall of Justice when Aaron Stovitz, head of the Trials Division of the District Attorney's Office and one of the top trial lawyers in an office of 450 deputy district attorneys, grabbed me by the arm and without a word of explanation hurried me down the hall into the office of J. Miller Levy, Director of Central Operations. Levy was talking to two LAPD lieutenants I'd worked with on previous cases, Bob Helder and Paul LePage. Listening for a minute, I heard the word Tate. Turning to Aaron, I asked, "Are we going to handle it?" He nodded affirmatively. My only comment was a low whistle. Helder and LePage gave us a sketchy resume of what Ronnie Howard had said. As a follow-up to Mossman and Brown's visit the previous night, two other officers had gone to Sybil Brand that morning and talked to Ronnie for a couple of hours. They had obtained considerably more detail, but there were still huge gaps in the story. To say that the Tate and LaBianca cases had been solved at this point would be a gross overstatement. Obviously, in any murder case, finding the killer is extremely important, but it's only a first step. Neither the finding, the arresting, nor the indicting of a defendant has evidentiary value, and none are proof of guilt. Once the killer is identified, there remains the difficult and sometimes insurmountable problem of connecting him with the crime by strong, admissible evidence, then proving his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, be it before a judge or a jury. And as yet we hadn't even made the first step, much less the second. In talking to Ronnie Howard, Susan Atkins had implicated herself and Charles, presumably meaning Charles Manson. But Susan had also said that others were involved, and we lacked their actual identities. This was on Tate. On LaBianca, there was virtually no information. One of the first things I wanted to do after reviewing the Howard and DiCarlo statements was to go to Spahn Ranch. Arrangements were made for me to go out the next morning with several of the detectives. I asked Aaron if he wanted to come along, but he couldn't make it. Although Aaron was my superior in the office, we had been assigned the case as co-prosecutors, each of us having an equal say in its handling. Though major, nationally prominent criminal cases of even less magnitude and complexity than the Tate LaBianca murders frequently have three and sometimes four prosecutors working on the case full-time, for some reason only Aaron and I were assigned to the case. Though neither Aaron nor I could have foreseen that months later he would be yanked off the case, leaving me to go it alone, I did realize from the start that owing to his other duties as head of the trials division, at least his pretrial participation would be limited. When I returned home late that afternoon and told my wife Gail that Aaron and I had been assigned the Tate case, she shared my excitement, but with reservations. She had been hoping that we could take a vacation. It had been months since I'd taken a full day off. Even when I was at home in the evenings, I was either reading transcripts, researching law, or preparing arguments. Although every day I made sure I spent some time with our two children, Vince Jr., 3, and Wendy, 5, when I was on a big case, I totally immersed myself in it. I promised Gail I'd try to take a few days off, but I honestly had to admit that it might be a while before I could do so. At that time, we were, fortunately, unaware that I would be living with the Tate LaBianca cases for almost 2 years, averaging 100 hours per week, rarely, if ever, getting to bed before 2 a.m., 7 days per week, and that the few moments Gail, the kids, and I had together would be devoid of privacy, our home transformed into a fortress, a bodyguard not only living with us but accompanying me everywhere I went, following a threat by Charles Manson that he would kill Bugliosi. November 19th to 21st, 1969. We'd picked a hell of a day for a search. The wind was incredible. By the time we reached Chatsworth, it was almost buffeting us off the road. It wasn't a long drive, well under an hour. From the Hall of Justice in downtown Los Angeles, it's about 30 miles to Chatsworth. Going north on Topanga Canyon Boulevard past Devonshire for about 2 miles, we made a sharp left onto Santa Susana Pass Road. Once heavily traveled, but in recent years bypassed for a faster freeway, the two-lane road winds upward a mile or two. Then suddenly, around a bend and to the left, there it was, Spahn's Movie Ranch. Its ramshackle main street was less than 20 yards from the highway, in plain view. Wrecked automobile and truck bodies littered the area. There wasn't a sign of life. There was an unreality to the place, accentuated by the roaring wind and the appearance of total desertion, but even more so by the knowledge, if the Atkins-Howard story was true, of what had begun and ended here. A run-down movie set off in the middle of nowhere, from which dark-clad assassins would venture out at night to terrorize and kill, then return before dawn to vanish into the surroundings. It might have been the plot of a horror film, except that Sharon Tate and at least 8 other real human beings were now dead. We pulled off onto the dirt road, stopping in front of the Long Branch Saloon. In addition to myself, there were Lieutenant Helder and Sergeant Calkins of the Tate team, Sergeant Lee of SID, Sergeants Gunther, Whiteley, and William Gleason from LASO, and our guide, Danny DiCarlo. Danny had finally agreed to accompany us, but only on one condition, that we handcuff him. That way, if any members of the family were still around, they wouldn't think he was voluntarily flapping to the fuzz. Though the sheriff's deputies had been to the ranch before, we needed DiCarlo for a specific purpose, to point out the areas where Manson and the family target practiced. The object of our search? Any .22-caliber bullets and or shell casings. But first I wanted to obtain George Spahn's permission to search the ranch. Gunther pointed out his shack, which was to the right and apart from the western set. We knocked, and a voice, that of a young girl, said, "Come right on in." It was as if every fly in the area had taken shelter there during the storm. 81-year-old George Spahn was sitting in a decaying armchair, wearing a Stetson and dark glasses. In his lap was a chihuahua, at his feet a cocker spaniel. A hippie girl of about 18 was fixing his lunch, while a transistor radio tuned to a cowboy station blared Young Love by Sonny James. It seemed as staged as the setting itself. According to DiCarlo, Manson called his girls Young Loves.